I was a wreck. I was so panicky. I was so nervous. I was practicing.
This whole thing around sort of, isn't it awful to be a woman in comedy? Oh my God. Women in comedy are just these put upon, terrible victims. Oh, the sexism it must go through. How can anyone do comedy? That does not help women get into comedy.
Most of our life, we're bending to the expectations of others. How we look, how we behave, where we work, the life choices that we make. It's like all these little decisions were made without us, and we're just expected to follow the choreography and hope we don't screw it up and stack it. But deep down, wouldn't it be liberating, and not to mention time-saving, if we were all just accepted the way we are? Sometimes it pays off to just throw yourself out there and say, "Take me as I am," which is the theme for this week's episode. You're listening to All the Best, FBI Radio's weekly documentary and storytelling show. I'm Jess Hamilton. When Lauren Klein started doing stand-up, she couldn't help but notice the lack of gender balance in comedy rooms. Sometimes it's just one lone lady up against a bunch of penis joke-cracking dudes dominating the stage. And it made Lauren wonder, why aren't there more women in stand-up? Do some people really still believe the myth that women aren't considered as funny as men? Or does it relate more to how women are expected to behave? Here's Lauren.
Yeah! It's my first ever stand-up comedy gig, January this year. I'm pacing on the spot at the back of the room. I'm facing the stage and mouthing the words to my set. Adrenaline is coursing through my body. I can still leave and no one will notice. Then my name is called. I take a deep breath and do a slow, Rocky Balboa run to the stage. I shake hands with the MC, take the microphone out of the stand, and face the audience.
Greetings, everyone. Everyone's been making that look very easy.
I'm told you can spot someone who's new to comedy by the way they handle the microphone. New comics struggle to lift the mic out of the stand in one smooth movement. Tonight, I'm the newbie.
So, for the longest period of time, I wanted to be an actress. And my mum says that she named me Lauren after the actress Lauren Bacall. My dad, however, says that I was named Lauren because it was the only name my parents could agree on that wasn't the name of one of his ex-girlfriends.
Oh!
And my dad had a lot of ex-girlfriends.
My family loves comedy, especially Eddie Izzard. When I was young, about 5 or 6, I started watching his recorded shows with them.
Because cake or death, that's a pretty easy question. Anyone can answer that. Cake or death? Cake, please.
I didn't always get the punchlines, but I enjoyed his performance and the audience laughter. There's always a joker in the past. Back in primary school, Kath and Kim was the show to watch. The show had a big impact on me. It was the first time I'd seen women dominate in comedy. But comedy only became an obsession after I finished uni. That was when I started to go and see stand-up gigs every week. And it's when I started thinking, maybe I could do this. As much as I wanted to get on stage, I had the impression that stand-up was a bit of a boys' club. When I'd check out the weekly comedy room lineups in Melbourne, out of 10 comics on a bill, only one, or at most two, were women. I wasn't the only one to notice the gender imbalance. At this year's Melbourne International Comedy Festival, less than a quarter of shows were solo female shows. Festival director Susan Proven said it's not as bad as it could be, but there is still a long way to go before the festival reaches gender parity. So, why aren't there more women doing stand-up? What's keeping women from entering the comedy circuit? To give us a clue, academic Barbara Joseph explains that in Australia, women don't fit the bill of the larrikin that we associate with funny blokes. female comedians are advised about what topics they can talk about, no periods please, and even what sort of clothing they should wear when performing. Nothing to distract from the jokes. Plus, it doesn't help that we have a culture of catcalling and gendered comments that are often yelled from the crowd. It's not hard to see why stand-up comedy has a reputation as a boys' club. All the signs are telling me comedy won't welcome voices like mine, but I can't ignore that I'm drawn to the stage and the thrill of making people laugh. So, I'm determined to give it a go. How can I prepare myself for a career in comedy as a woman?
Hi, I'm Prue Blake. I've started comedy about a year and a half ago when I moved to Melbourne. I started doing improv because all my comedy heroes were doing it. That's where they all started. So the Broad City Girls, Amy Poehler, Tina Fey. I was like, if they can do it, I can probably do it.
Prue and I met at a comedy writing night in Melbourne run by a group called Gaggle. We were both really into comedy, but we were also really nervous about doing our first stand-up gig. So we arranged to test out our new material at an open mic night.
And I was a wreck. I was so panicky. I was so nervous. I was practicing to myself at home all day, procrastinating study, and just saying these jokes over and over again, trying to, you know, make sure that I was comfortable when I was on stage. But getting to go with a group of girls that were all just starting, that you knew were supportive, that was a really, really good experience and a great first gig.
We both noticed that there were a lot more male comedians at the open mic night than women.
I've been told my whole life, you know, as a woman, you've got to be prepared, and I think you're automatically told to be more cautious, more less likely to throw caution to the wind. Whereas I think a lot of men just seem to go, I'll just jump on stage and see how it flies. And I don't know if it's less fear of vulnerability or rejection or it going badly, where I would see that as the scariest possible thing, to go on stage and not be prepared and just see what comes out and see how it goes. So I found that everyone has been very welcoming, if not a little, they want you to pay your dues. I've definitely got a vibe that you have to prove your comedy chops before you get into a, there's an in crowd and an out crowd.
A lot of people come in and out of comedy, and to a certain extent starting comedy isn't actually the hard part, it's staying in comedy.
That's Bock.
Hello, my name is Lauren Bock. I have been doing stand-up for about 5 years now. My style, I guess, is somewhere between the Lucille Ball and probably Amy Schumer, I don't know. Where every, you know, 10 people that do their first gig, maybe one of them might make it to their 100th gig, because it takes a while and it takes energy, and energy that you could be spent doing other things, 100%. Laundry, a vegetable garden, like meaningful relationships, no. Or, you know, so it does, it's a commitment of energy.
Bock has been in the comedy circuit for years. She and many others in the scene have noticed that there are more women doing stand-up than there ever have been before. But she understands why there aren't more women taking the stage.
I think women are socialised from a really young age to be accepted, to be nice. You know, like that we're told that, you know, we're not allowed to make mistakes. As women, we're not sort of, you know, told to pick yourself up and dust yourself off. You have to do something perfect straight away. And that is how we are rewarded. And I think there is a massive fear of people not laughing at you, you know, or laughing at you but not with you, or whatever it is. There is a fear of getting up and being isolated and alone. Again, women are, you know, supposed to be surrounded by people all the time. Like, we're supposed to be mothers, we're supposed to be partners, we're supposed to be everything. A woman alone is considered a very bad thing. So all these things lead down the path to stand-up comedy, you know, like someone standing up there completely alone with their own opinions, with, you know, no one around them as a safety net or anything like that. You know, it is a completely isolated sort of medium.
For me, one of the biggest factors that stopped me from getting involved in stand-up comedy was the lack of female representation on stage.
Sometimes it can feel intimidating when when there aren't as many women out there, or women aren't doing the thing, and you think, oh, there's no space for me. But if you can get past that, there are audiences that want to see. I think that there are audiences that want to see women.
That's Deanna.
I'm an American comedy artist, and I create and hopefully cultivate immersive comedy, which is some sort of blend of improv and clown and buffon and physical theater and interactive installations.
Deanna is a comedy veteran. She's performed all around the world for the past 20 years and has won heaps of awards. But her time on stage hasn't always been easy.
When I was coming up in the improv world in New York, it was, I mean, like, I couldn't get on stage without being sexualized by the guy that I was on stage with. Like, even when I would set up that I was a doctor or something, and he would be like, oh, stop hitting on me. I mean, it was hilarious to me. And I think that I felt sort of victimized by that until I decided to kind of flip that on its ear and make work that dealt with, I think that some of my first kind of creations were just dealing with sexuality, because at least I was in control of the thing that was being foisted upon me.
Deanna's experience in comedy is not unique. Stories like hers can understandably deter women from entering comedy.
I think there is a very hard narrative at the moment, because I feel like women, this whole thing around sort of, oh, isn't it awful to be a woman in comedy? Oh, my God. And you kind of get this sort of, like, feminist kind of counteract, which is that women in comedy are just these put-upon, terrible victims. Would someone think of the poor female comedians, oh, the sexism it must go through. How can anyone do comedy? That does not help women get into comedy. It's actually really counterproductive. Yes, there is, you know, sexism, like in any other industry, it's very male-dominated, but, you know, I think everybody is working towards an end goal. No one is sitting on the fence about it. Like, this is the new movement, and this is going to happen.
Thankfully, there are positive changes happening in the comedy scene. There are comedy nights like Lemon Comedy in Melbourne, dedicated to amplifying and celebrating underrepresented voices. There are open mic rooms that actively seek to book 50% female comedians on their bills. And there's groups like Gaggle, run by Lauren Haywood and Lauren Bock.
Gaggle is at the moment, it is a one day workshop for women, female and female identifying, non-binary, basically anyone that isn't straight and white and male. It's a workshop for a day where you learn improv, stand-up and clowning. And I think the thing I get out of it the most is seeing women connect with each other, make each other laugh, have a really good day, and walk away feeling so confident about going forward and getting on a stage.
I want to see more women on stage, because I think that I'm just tired of how many more male stories do we need? Like, we're done. Like, we've had them for centuries. And I think that there's a need, and I think that the audiences know that there's a need for other voices.
I think people think there's one universal kind of comedy that's funny sort of thing. And that is not true. You know, it takes all kinds, and it's only because we haven't been given all kinds as a comedy consuming audience that we believe that there isn't. So the best way you can support it is by going to see women. You can give them money to go and see their shows. You can come to a Gaggle. You can tell a female friend that's very funny that they should be a comedian. You should encourage them. You should tell them that. Or if you yourself have always wanted to give it a go, you are funny, you should go and do that. No one's stopping you from doing it except yourself. That's what I find with comedy a lot of the time. It's like, you know, if no one's putting the comedy gun to your head. So sometimes it can take a while to walk through the door, I guess.
But what I particularly love is mimicking, and I even went through a phase...
After a minute or so of being on stage, I start to relax.
On tonight's episode of Tattoo Tales, we meet Graham, a middle-aged divorcee...
A bell chimes from the back of the room. I've passed the three-minute mark. I'm nearly done.
...which says, I'm a wanker.
And then, as quickly as it started,
so tough. But, you know, this is the feeling of, you know, making a whole room of people laugh and that whole approval. I mean, that's the other thing. Like, with great risk comes great reward, especially if your particular brand of risk and what makes you feel really good is making a bunch of people laugh. Then that is highly, highly addictive. It's like crack.
Correct.
Yeah. So I'm addicted to comedy, basically. Sorry, I cannot help you. I cannot help myself.
That story was by Lauren Klein, with help from supervising producers Beth Gibson, Selena Shannon, and Beck Fiery. And like Lauren said, if you want to support women in stand-up, there's a really easy way you can do it, and that's by buying tickets and going to shows. If you want to find out more about how you can get involved with groups like Gaggle, so you can smash the comedy patriarchy, we'll put some links up on our website, allthebestradio.com. On top of surviving her first stand-up gig, this was also Lauren's first All the Best story. In fact, most of the stories we play on All the Best are first-time radio makers. If you want to support emerging producers like Lauren, you can tell your friends about All the Best and subscribe to our podcast or even leave us a review. You're listening to All the Best, and this week we're tackling the theme, Take Me As I Am. When you start a new relationship with someone, we always expect at least a little bit of baggage. Hangovers from our past life that we try to keep hidden for as long as possible. But often it's just a matter of time before that baggage rears its head and threatens to make or break the new love.
How much tea have you had today?
Only one cup. Yes, can you put the kettle on?
When my partner Jason arrived in Australia from the US, I knew, or maybe assumed, he had a bit of debt. Many Americans of our generation do, because they generally have to take out bank loans in order to go to university. But we never really talked about it. I assumed he was handling it. I was naive. We had met in Argentina 3 years before, and when he moved back to the US and I moved back to Australia, we somewhat unwillingly stayed in touch by email and Skype. One of us was usually a bit shouty, coming back from a party, the other just waking up, bleary and quiet. We talked at unlikely hours of the day and night for 3 years, until it became clear we needed to try this out in the real world. He moved to Australia in 2013. In those first few months, meeting each other again, we talked about everything. We didn't talk about money. I did notice some strange behaviour from him, though. When he went to get cash out of the ATM, he would seem to disappear into a well of anxiety that I didn't understand and I couldn't get him out of. He told me he very rarely looked at his bank balance. It scared him too much. He would get official-looking letters in the mail from a place called Great Lakes Borrower Service. I would often find these letters around the house, with their bold, all-caps red letters on the front. Payment required now. I eventually confronted him about it. It took a number of attempts on my part, but I finally got the information out of him. It became clear that he owed some American banks, plural, what amounted to $40,000 for his degree. The anxiety of this crippled him, and the way he was dealing with it was to pretend it didn't exist. I could see what the debt was doing to him, and I wanted to get rid of the anxiety as soon as possible.
Is it okay? Okay.
There's something very uncomfortable about it.
It's hard to talk about money. Admittedly, this is a classic case of avoidance behavior. I never really developed a plan to pay off my uni debt after I graduated. I didn't really even understand it, although I was often reminded that I was the one who signed all the documents and accepted the 6% compounding interest, whatever the hell that was. Initially, I got off to a good start, though. Once I finished uni, I got a job through a federal program that put a pause on my loans and helped me pay off a certain amount. But somewhere along the line, I stopped making regular payments. My income was irregular as I was working two casual jobs, at a nonprofit by day and bar by night. The letters started to pile up in the hallway beside the door in my group house. The more letters I received, the more I ignored them. I wasn't sure how I was going to pay off the debt and afford to pay everything else. So following in a long line of avoiders before me, I buried the debt like a family secret. When I moved to Sydney, I worried about how I was going to pay for an unfavorable exchange rate and interest rate at the same time. When Sophie finally confronted me, I had to admit that I didn't have control of the situation any longer, and no one else really knew what was going on. The interesting thing to note here is that there's nothing exceptional about how I decided to pay for uni in the American context. There's nothing exceptional about racking up $40,000 for an undergraduate degree. In fact, the average student debt in the U.S. is $35,000. So with 43 million other Americans with student loan debt, you'd think that I was in good company. But in reality, I felt completely alone and helpless.
Thank you for calling Great Lakes Educational Loan Services.
Si desea escuchar la información en español, oprima el número 9.
To make a payment,
we decided to pay it off quickly and aggressively. We took some extreme measures. We started to send every cent of my income to these American banks every month, losing hundreds of dollars on the ever-depreciating exchange rate and on international transfer fees every single time. At one point, seeing how serious we were about all this, my parents, bless them, stepped in to pay off the balance of the loan. But we had to pay them back quickly. We knuckled down. Jason worked two jobs, waiting tables at night and picking up any casual labouring work he could find during the day, in Italian valve factories, in warehouses that made labels for cleaning products. All my income went to the debt. It felt like we were taking stacks of hard-earned cash and just chucking it out the window. We lived entirely off Jason's income. We pared down our budget to the absolute minimum to keep body and soul together. Every week, Jason would commute for 2 hours by train and bus in order to go to an incredibly cheap Chinese fruit and veg store, so we could keep our entire food costs for the week to $40. We didn't buy clothes, we didn't get haircuts. We caught buses at random times of the day and night to get free travel on our Opal cards. We delayed dealing with health issues. I needed to go to the dermatologist, I put it off. I needed to buy birth control, I put it off. We wound back our social life. We missed friends' special occasions, we didn't replace Jason's irreparably broken phone, or the shoes that were permanently falling off his feet.
We kind of got almost competitive about it, really. We took it to, once we settled in, it's like running. When you first start running, it's awful and uncomfortable. And then you kind of get into a groove and then you just feel fine. And then you kind of forget what it felt like not to run.
We asked for help. Generous friends donated furniture, kitchenware, and a waterlogged mattress. When I got a new job, more friends donated work-appropriate clothes that I couldn't afford to buy. Our friends and family really showed up for us, even though we never really revealed to our friends the extent of the austerity.
I guess what it's worth considering is that if it was so hard for us, and we were both fully employed most of that time. We're both young, healthy, fit people. We had help. We had a lot of help. We're both middle class, you know. If it was so difficult for us and it had such long-term detrimental effects on our mental health, imagine what it must be like for people who don't have all of those advantages, being the majority of the US population.
Mm-hmm.
We paid off the debt 5 weeks ago. It took us 18 months. Since then, we've been feeling very thoughtful about the whole process and how it has affected our behaviour. We're relieved it's all over and we can enter the land of the living again. At the time, it felt like we were desperately holding our breath, hoping nothing would go wrong, feeling that any small slip-up could cause the whole fragile ecosystem to come crumbling down.
I feel like we just kind of blacked out and got it done. But then once we came out the other side, it was actually kind of hard to, you know, to readjust to post-debt life.
There have been consequences of deciding to pay it off quickly. Unfortunately, the long-term effects of this process are not quickly shaken off. The aggressive repayments, originally designed to relieve Jason of the anxiety and guilt the debt was causing him, actually served to broaden the anxiety from one of us to both of us.
One thing that I didn't anticipate was that I would still feel anxious about money, and unfortunately, I have projected that onto you. I mean, I owe you a great deal for this whole thing, and one of the things I feel worst about the whole thing is that I made you experience this acute anxiety that I feel around money.
I guess what I expected to happen was that once we'd paid the debt off, that would all go away.
Mm.
And I didn't find that at all. In fact, just the other day, I had to go to a work dinner and I had a panic attack because it cost $13 more than I had budgeted for that night, which is ridiculous.
Mm.
So I think it's something that has had long-term effects on both of us and on our relationship. In a cliche way, what I learned from this experience was that I think we really need to learn to talk about money, and we need to have better language to discuss it, because our generation, or I don't know, people who are educated and middle class tend to be good at political conversations about broader social and economic forces, and potentially not as good at discussing their own financial struggles that they're going through.
Yeah. It's taboo. But we're doing better now.
That story was by Sophie Duxon and Jason LeCuyer, with help from supervising producer Selena Shannon, and was first broadcast in September 2016. Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon, our Victorian state coordinator is Beck Fari, our community coordinator is Chloe Gillespie, Beth Gibson is our SYN production manager, Tegan Nichols compiles our show, and I'm Jess Hamilton. Our artwork is designed by Annie Hamilton, and our theme music is composed by Shining Bird. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're at it, subscribe to our podcast on your favourite podcast app.